The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Monday afternoon. How are you? They're going to have great sport with 2020 and reeling in the ears, aren't they? It's only the beginning of March and we've had Emma and Dennis and Jorge and all sorts of things and coronavirus and rugby matches being called off and people with masks, and it's a mad one. We're only 2 months into the year. Definitely February must have been the wettest on record. Like wet. How did you survive the weekend? You're okay, yeah? You survived Jorge. I'd say most people stayed in, batting down the hatches and all that. I went out and exposed myself to Jorge. Nearly got blown away. The great thing is, of course, you get one of those free dermabrasion treatments on your face and you don't have to go in and listen to that music and smell those scented candles. You just go out into the wild of Jorge and your face gets battered and I look all fresh. I look about 21. No, I don't. Big news from me, yes. Congrats, your mobile number has been selected as the winner of $700,000 in the International Ballot Award Programme. Send your winning reference to this and you just sit, 700 grand. I got it on WhatsApp. 700 grand the richer. I wonder, is that anything to do with the missed call I got from Nicaragua? I don't know. Probably has. I won't be replying to that. Although it's tempting. 700,000. Sort out a lot. Do you know what I did over the weekend? Which I haven't done ever in my life, my long-legged life. I made brown bread. Because we had the lady in, Anne-Marie, and she set me and comedian Emma Doran a challenge to make brown bread, and we're supposed to present it to her on Friday. And me being star pupil and all that sort of thing, I said I'd do a dry run, a rehearsal. So I set about getting the ingredients and making brown bread over the weekend. So I got my whole meal flour, my plain flour, my soda thingamajig, bread soda, salt, buttermilk. Buttermilk. There you go. I hadn't had buttermilk in the house ever, I think. And butter. And I was there going through it. It's easy enough to make. To get it right is probably a bigger challenge. But I was there doing, I was at the process where you put the butter in to the flour and the salt and that mixture. It's 25 grams of soft butter. And I can't remember which recipe I was using, but the person described as using one of your hands like a claw. And moving your fingers together, work the butter into the flour mixture. And as I was doing that, I was transported back to my granny's kitchen about 40 or 50 years ago. Granny Bonner, Donny Bonner was her name, and she made the best brown bread ever. And I was often in her company as she was making it. And I was just transported back, and the smells and the sight of my hand and the butter and all that sort of thing. She was an amazing woman. You'd hear her before you'd see her. Toodaloo, toodaloo. That was Donny Bonner. And you'd go up to the market on a Thursday in the square in Kildare and you'd be separated from your granny as, you know, an eight-year-old or a six-year-old. And all you'd do was listen out for the toodaloo and you'd find Donny Bonner, an amazing woman, and her brown bread was amazing. I could never match her brown bread, but I'll be attempting to do it. So made it, baked it, ate it. Yeah, not up to Donny Bonner standard, but edible and good with butter. And that was nice. And you know what I rediscovered over the weekend? Sardines. I can't remember the last time I had a sardine out of a tin. You'd have them on holidays. You'd have a plate of sardines, fresh ones. But I can't remember that the last time I had. And do you know the way they say that you should never go food shopping on an empty stomach because you buy things that you don't need or want and they go to waste? And I think that's good advice. But I went shopping for food on Friday evening on an empty stomach and I saw sardines and I said, I'll have some of those. I don't know why. So brought them home, and then Saturday after I've been out in Jorge, I'm back in. I had some bread, some rocket, some onions, sardines on top in olive oil and a dash of Tabasco. And my word, delish, delish, delish. And of course, you know what you're getting from sardines. You're getting that omega-3. Which everyone says is so important. Well, they did up until today. I read in the Irish Times today, omega-3 supplements do not protect against cancer, researchers find. And they don't do much good for heart disease either. They do a little, but it's minimal. So, and it's quite expensive to go out and buy those supplements. I remember I was paying 28 quid a shot for those. I stopped taking them. I tried to have fish at least three times a week, and the experts say that's a lot better than spending money in health shops on omega-3 oil capsules. See, it's all connected, isn't it? The sardines and the omega-3. And I saw Parasite over the weekend, which isn't connected at all. Do you know the movie, the film, as we say in Kildare, the film that won the best picture Oscar at the Oscars this year? It's a South Korean sort of black comedy, social satire. You have the Park family, who were hugely wealthy, and then you have the Kim family, who were hugely poor, and their paths cross, and then chaos ensues. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant movie. And I know you're going to say, subtitled, Ray, I'm not going to watch it subtitled. Well, if you watch it in the cinema, subtitles are easier to take in the cinema because they're so big. And after 5 minutes, you forget they're even there. Whatever way the brain works, it's just like your senses of reading and hearing amalgamate in your brain, and you don't even cop that you're reading subtitles anymore. A little bit more difficult, I'd imagine, when you're sitting at home with a glass of wine, you're trying to squint to read the subtitles. Anyway, highly recommended. Highly recommended movie. You won't be disappointed. Brilliantly directed by Bong Joon-ho, as if I know, but it just looks spectacular. It looks spectacular. Everything about it, you couldn't fault it. Parasite, highly recommended from here. And while we're over that neck of the woods, and I don't want to talk too much about coronavirus because it's wall to wall, but there is a new way that people are greeting each other around the world. It's called the Wuhan Shake. So they're telling us now that we shouldn't shake hands for fear of transmitting the virus. So what people are doing now is they're kicking each other. Well, not really kicking each other, but when you come up to somebody, you hold out your right foot, as in you lift your right foot in the air, and then you just tap off the inside of the other person's right foot. And then you do the same thing with the left foot, tap off the inside of their left foot, and that's in place of a handshake for the moment, until things normalise in the future. Now, we're talking to a man today called Dennis. And Dennis first did his driving test 40 years ago. And I know this because he features in a programme that's on tonight with Simon Delaney called The Test. And it's about people's experience of doing the driving test. And we've all been there. We've all been, well, most of us have anyway. Dennis is going to come into us after 4 o'clock to tell us about his experience. I can share my experience with you if you share with me, if you share your experience. It took me 3 attempts. Now, it was very wet the first day I took my test, and it was around Nace, and it was a Friday evening, a lot of traffic and all of that. That's my excuse. Can't remember what happened the second time, and then I got it the third time. And then a mate of mine who will remain nameless, he got those dispensations. So he has never done his test because there was a time there was such a backlog for full licenses that anybody who had 2 provisional licenses automatically got a full one. So there are people in this country, and you're some of them listening, who have never done a test at all. So we'll be talking to Dennis, and that's tonight ahead of the test. So if you have any big story about your driving test, do let us know, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. There's a difference in baking soda and baking powder. I'm never sure. There is. Yes, I looked it up over the weekend. There is a difference. And one is for acidic and the other is for non-acidic. So you use one because you have the buttermilk, which is acidic. See, I read that over the weekend. Just put it in online. But I had to check. You forgot the treacle in the brown bread. Okay, there was no mention of the treacle in the recipes I had. Sorry about that. Hey Ray, welcome aboard to the brown bread making club. I did it many moons ago for the lads I was sharing digs with. Never did it before. I just remember my mum making it. It was a huge hit. They even ate it hot. Alas, I got tasked to make it every second day after that, says Reg. And some bran and wheat germ is lovely added to the brown bread, says Rhea. Well, keep your tips coming in. This isn't really fair because Emma Doran doesn't have the ability to tap into all your expertise. But any, I tell you what I'll do, just to be fair, because both of us have to make brown bread for this Friday, and Anne-Marie will be sampling it on air in our baking challenge. So any information that I get from you today about brown bread, I will pass on to Emma, and she can use it if she wishes or not, whatever. Right, 51551 ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. Florence and the Machine. Dog days are over on RT Radio 1. Great to hear that again. It took me 3 times to pass 2. Did I mention that Dennis failed when he did his driving test 40 years ago? Maybe I didn't, but he did. And he's back to do it again on telly. And he's in to talk to us about it after 4 o'clock. Anyway, Toddy in London says, took me 3 times to pass 2. First time, the little Nissan Micra steamed up and I couldn't find the Mr. button. Second time, the examiner's anorak was too noisy and put me off. That's my excuse anyway. Obviously got a 3rd time round, Toddy. And somebody else on driving. In 1994, I failed my first driving test as my tester was being tested also. Aha. So 3 in the car, passed 2nd time round with same tester on his own. Thank God for that. Months later, says Debbie in Walkinstown. And on baking, how do you feel about nuts in your brown bread? We are divided in our house. I love the crunch, but it's a big no-no for my hubby. Can you help us solve the argument? Elaine and Brian. Well, it's solved for us at home because we have a nut allergy in the house. So no nuts in the house, no nuts and brown bread. So that's sort of for us. So I don't have a comment. I don't have an opinion on that. And my 10-year-old daughter made gluten-free brown bread on Saturday during the storm and it was absolutely beautiful, says Anna. Nice thing to do during the storm, isn't it? Do a bit of baking. And on Parasite, you can't be serious about Parasite. It was definitely the worst movie I've ever seen. Depressing from start to finish, and I'm not the only one who thinks that, says Marianne. It's supposed to be a tragic comedy, a black comedy. Obviously, you didn't see the funny side of it. And on back to driving test, Padder has been on. He says, I studied for my driving test 20 years ago using an old video you yourself featured in. Oh, did you? For some driving test centre, and I passed it first time. Even had to attempt the very same hill start featured in the video, which is in Churchtown. Yes, it is. Many thanks, Maestro, says Padder. I remember making that. It was a terrible red jacket. And the guy who produced that went on to produce movies and all sorts of TV programmes that have been shown all over the world. Alan Maloney. So from meagre beginnings, doing a driving test video with me. Anyway, 51551, ray@rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Elaine's been on to us. She says, my hubby of 81 years, he obviously not married 81 years, he is 81, yeah, made his first Irish soda bread last week and it was delicious. He also eats sardines almost every day and having waited 3 days for some laminate flooring to arrive, has just carried 28 packs into the living room as the delivery man was unable to do so. My husband is just going to make another loaf now in case we get a lockdown. Aha, that's Elaine. And my first driving test, I hit the curb and bursted my tyre and driving instructor had to change it in the rain. Didn't pass, as you would expect. And Assumpta says, a girl I worked with years ago did her driving test. This was in the days before the theory test, but you still had to know the rules of the road as you were asked a number of related questions. Yes, I remember that. That was me. The tester asked her what signs she might expect to see on a country road. Her mind went blank, couldn't think of an answer. Then she said, pick your own strawberries. She failed. Something Lamar. Right. Johan Verbruggen sits in front of me. In January of this year, a 6-year-old girl called Alice Hayes, through her mother, settled her High Court action against the National Maternity Hospital for €400,000 for injuries sustained during her birth. Her solicitor was Johan Verbruggen of Kalantansi Solicitors. And Johan has a great story to tell because he himself was injured in a similar fashion to Alice at the time of his birth back in 1989.
Yep.
Johan, good afternoon.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for having me on.
So when is your birthday?
29th of December.
Okay. Yep. So you're just 30 and 2 months.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Okay. congratulations on winning that case for
Thank
Alice.
You. Thanks, it's
an amazing symmetry to your life, isn't it?
It is.
The way it's worked out.
Yeah, I suppose I kind of feel it is vocational for me in that being able to help someone who at the age of 6 settled her case. My case was settled when I was 6 and I know it means an awful lot to the family once the case is put behind them. But it's a hard battle, obviously, while it's ongoing.
Yeah.
So it's nice to put it to bed
and
to have justice, I suppose, as far as we see it, would be justice, you know.
You know an awful lot about your own case.
Mm-hmm.
You had long chats, obviously, with your mum, did
I have,
you? was it in the lead up to a case like Alice's or just over the years?
Over the years, I mean, mum was the chairperson of the Herbs Palsy Association, the charity, which she set up in 1998. And from going to those family days, and just by osmosis, I've heard pretty much what happened at my birth. So I know how,
okay.
I suppose, how I don't understand as much as she does, obviously, how traumatic it was, but I've heard enough to know that it was particularly.
Okay, so tell us what you know then about your birth.
Yeah, so just background information. Mum's a type 1 diabetic, so diabetic mothers tend to have large babies when compared with non-diabetic mums. And in 1987, she had my older brother, Stefan, in Hollis Street, and he was 8 pounds, 3 ounces at full term. And there was difficulty delivering him in that when his head was delivered, his shoulder was caught behind the pubic bone. So when that happens, it's an emergency because while the baby is stuck in the birth canal, its umbilical cord is being compressed. So there's a danger of the baby not getting enough oxygen.
So one arm of the head is out, is it?
Well, no, just the head.
Just the head.
The shoulder would be facing, the caught shoulder would be facing the ceiling. It would be under the mum's stomach,
okay.
Essentially.
Yes.
So there are manoeuvres to get the baby out in that emergency situation. And Stefan was delivered and unscathed by it. But the fact that mum was a type 1 diabetic and my brother experienced what that's called shoulder dystocia, there are kind of forewarnings that it could happen again with the next baby. So fast forward 2.5 years and mum and dad are now living in Galway with Stefan. Dad set up a veterinary practice down there. And they went to an obstetrician privately. And he was aware of mum's, both her history and the birth history. But the pregnancy itself was largely uneventful. But at 36 weeks, she attended for a routine scan with the registrar. So not with the obstetrician that she was paying privately. But the registrar did a scan and filled in the growth chart and said to mum that she thought I could be a dangerously big baby.
Yeah. Right, okay.
And marked it at the, I think 10 pounds is the highest the scale went to. Mum remembers that. So
this would have been expected because your mum has type 1 diabetes,
exactly,
as you
exactly.
explained. Yeah.
I mean, it's not necessarily that one will follow the other, but it's definitely a higher chance of it happening. So, when she went a week later for an arranged appointment with the obstetrician, she similarly said that she was, you know, worried about the size and asked, could she be induced? And the obstetrician said, oh, ye women and your vanity, I don't think there's anything wrong. And mum kind of said, well, look, I really am concerned. So he reluctantly agreed to book mum in for induction the following day, the 29th of December. So she was induced at about 7 a.m. And it went on for the day. I mean, labour should be kind of quickening as it gets towards the crescendo, the delivery. But mine slowed down, which is another warning sign that it was going to be a difficult birth. And it was approximately 10 o'clock at night, I think, that the obstetrician was called and the pushing was to commence. But before that, the registrar had told mum during the day that she believed it would be a cesarean section.
Uh-huh. An emergency cesarean.
It wasn't emergency just yet, but she felt it was in my best interest and mum's best interest to go by cesarean. But when the consultant came in, he was in a tuxedo. I think it was at Christmas time, so he was in a tux, but he came in and the registrar said, I think it should be a cesarean. And the obstetrician said, no, we're not doing cesarean tonight. And she folded her arms across her chest and said, well, if it's not cesarean section, I'm having nothing more to do with this delivery. So she walked out in protest.
Okay.
So the pushing commenced. My head was delivered after the use of forceps and quite a bit of pulling. And inevitably, my right shoulder got caught behind the pubic bone. And again, I'm in that dangerous situation where if I'm not delivered soon enough, I'm going to suffer hypoxic ischemia, you know, a lack of oxygen to the brain. So they started pulling, but the force that they were pulling with meant that my dad had to push the bed that mum was on, back towards the wall. And the obstetrician was pulling my head, and the midwife was pulling the obstetrician. And by the time I was delivered,
you have a smile on your face. It does sound like
I know. Well, look, I'm it's third person for me. It's yours. I wasn't there for it's mum's story, really. You know, this bit.
So your head was in a forceps.
Yeah,
held by the obstetrician,
mm-hmm.
being pulled by the midwife.
Yeah, well, they're all kind of pulling. It was a team effort.
Your dad was trying to hold the...
Push the bed against the wall. And the bed ended up on the other side of the delivery room by the time I was delivered. So that's the extent of the force that was used. Now, what that's doing is that's tearing the muscle, the nerves in the brachial plexus. That's the area between your shoulder and your neck. It's tearing them from the spinal cord. So when I was delivered, I wasn't obviously screaming. I had to be resuscitated, and it took a fair amount of attempts and time to resuscitate.
And what's the APGAR score?
APGAR scores are the measurements for how a baby tolerated the delivery process. You ideally would be 9 or 10 at 1 minute or 9 or 10 at 5 minutes. I was 0 at 10 minutes, so it was I'd imagine would have been unethical nearly to revive me after a certain stage. I was so profoundly unable to cope with the way I was essentially dead. The paediatrician, when he revived me, said as much to Mum. He didn't know what he'd left her with.
Oh, I see. So he revived you, but he was going. I don't know.
Brain, in terms of brain damage, because yes. I mean that was they were highly suspicious of that because it was such a traumatic delivery, and I was out for so long, if you want to put it that way.
Okay.
So thankfully, I wasn't. But the obstetrician had left, and he came in the following day, but insisted on speaking to Dad, not to Mum. I suppose 1989, maybe it was the thing. But he sat at the end of Mum's bed with his back to her and told Dad that Mum hadn't pushed hard enough, and that's why they had to do all the pulling. So it created some complex of blame in her, yes. That she felt that it was her fault for not pushing hard enough.
Right. So you mentioned it already when you were talking about the charity that your mum had set up, Erb's Palsy.
Erb's Palsy, yeah.
Yes. So eventually you were diagnosed with Erb's Palsy.
I was.
And what is the manifestation of that?
So my right arm is 4 inches shorter than my left, and essentially the only fingers I can use are my index finger and my thumb, but barely. I can't lift my arm above my head. I can't extend it much further than where it's crooked at the shoulder. It's essentially ornamental as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't do a whole lot for me on a day-to-day basis. So as a child, obviously, I couldn't play musical instruments. Two-arm sports weren't really a goer either. Soccer, my balance was affected by it. So even soccer, if you push me from the right-hand side, I was on the floor pretty quickly. And then obviously into adolescence, you become self-aware.
Yeah, well, let's bring it back. Don't go into adolescence. Don't sprint on into adolescence.
Okay, right, I'll come back. Yeah, no problem.
So you would have been sort of unaware at six that your parents decided, or at five, in the lead up to your sixth birthday, that your parents were taking a case on your behalf?
I was unaware I was aware when they settled the case.
Okay.
They told me that, the arm was so undeniably bad that I knew that I had a good arm and a bad arm, as I put it, and as they put it. And I knew a doctor had made a mistake and the doctor was going to say sorry. And the doctor, when they settled the case, that I got some money as well. Now, that was it.
So he said sorry and he gave you some money.
That's what they said. No, he didn't. They didn't. That's what they told me. Yes, obviously, you'd think maybe as a five-year-old, going on six, I wouldn't be able to appreciate that. But it did help to know.
Go on.
Well, as you get older, there are times where you don't like the fact that you're disabled. But it's nice to know that. Well, it's nice to think that there's been justice and that the person who did it didn't necessarily get away with it, in one sense, I suppose. And it was important. It was important to know that at a younger age.
Yeah. And I suppose with adolescence comes frustration and anger.
Yeah. There was definitely anger. There was definitely anger.
Because at a younger age, you don't really get that.
And you're friends with kids who only know you in the arm, and they don't. I mean, like, I'm as liable to be picked on over my name as over my arm. You know, in
Johan Verbruggen.
Yeah, in West Galway. You know, so I mean,
well, you better get that out of the way then.
Where that comes from? Yeah. Is it? Oh yeah, my granddad's from Antwerp. So
okay,
it's very boring compared to this story, I think. Anyway, So when you're a child, you know, you're not maybe you wouldn't get slagged really as much. It is adolescence where everyone kind of rushes to be the same and to be not noticed, that it gets a bit difficult from then on. And I suppose I maybe took on more worry, and maybe, you know, Mum and Dad, the worry started for me there, but up until that point it was Mum and Dad's worry about where I'd end up, because it was a very much play it by ear. Will I be mentally disabled? Will I be able to go to normal school? Because they were told multiple times I wouldn't be able to do, you know, French and Irish. My brain my brain wasn't able to handle those subjects. It was English, and, you know, I'd have to go to remedial class. I had a stammer because my right arm was my dominant arm, so I had to learn to use my left, and that created a stammer for a couple of years. So
is that because the left-hand side of your brain operates the right-hand side of your body?
Exactly.
And that's the area that deals with speech, is it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's why I had a stammer for 2 years. Remedial classes, physiotherapy non-stop. So there were summers where I'd be kind of spent in Galway Hospital, the very place that it happened, undergoing physiotherapy while my friends would be out playing. So that kind of has an effect as well.
Yes.
FOMO, fear of missing out. Your friends are all doing things and you're kind of stuck in there. But there'd be anger at that, really, but without understanding why, you know.
So adolescence then.
When you start to become attracted to the opposite sex and you're kind of worried about what they might think, and your head is racked with how would you explain what happened. You don't want to go into as much detail as I've gone into here, but you also want to tell them what happened. And you're hoping, number one, they don't notice, but then you're also hoping that if they notice, they won't be you know, I don't know, they won't be kind of weirded out by it. So that's difficult. But as you get older, I suppose, and you go into college, people are very, you know, accepting, and you realise that, you know, everyone's got their own things, everyone's got their own hang-ups, and, you know, you went to an all-boys school, so you'd get slagged over the arm, but no more than I'd slag someone over their nose or their ears, or, you know, it's all part of the...
And we spoke about your limitations around sport. Mm-hmm. So at a certain time then, you must be thinking about, what do I do when I, you know, leave school, leave college, and what are the limitations there?
Yeah, I suppose it was, again, it was brought into the conversation early with me as a child that there are things I won't be able to do, and there's kind of, it's better to kind of know rather than go pursuing it and disappointing myself, or, you know. So Dad's a vet. I loved working with Dad during the summers, and veterinary maybe is something I would have liked to have done. From doing this job, I love medicine. Not that people might expect me to say that, but I do like medicine, and it's something that obviously, ironically, a doctor kind of deprived me of the opportunity to become a doctor before I ever had a chance to realise it. So, yeah, those career paths are kind of closed down, and I really was between accounting and law and maybe something to do with commerce, but law was the thing that interested me. And obviously, Mum and Dad spoke so well of their experience of the solicitor and the barrister and how they gave them the answers the doctors weren't willing to give them, that obviously had an influence on me and how I saw law and the importance of it.
Yeah. Mm. And were you an argumentative child?
Very, yeah. My argument skills, they've improved, but I think I was always arguing, and it wouldn't surprise Mum, I think, that I ended up being a solicitor, yeah.
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 And you applied, but it's not a foregone conclusion you're going to get it.
The law?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a hope more than expectation that I'd actually... Yeah, I didn't think I did well enough in school, but I suppose, yeah, the study paid the last few months before the Leaving Cert knuckling down did. And, yeah, but it's amazing how once I was in doing my law degree in NUIG, how kind of doing tort law, which is what medical negligence would be part of, that was the bit that got my attention. And then, you know, it's really from starting with Cal and Tansy that I realise I really do love it, and it gives me a great sense of kind of, I suppose, self-fulfillment, if it doesn't sound too cheesy.
Like it's an amazing story. Hmm. It is an amazing story. Like, you could write a movie about your life.
Oh God.
No, you could. Yeah. You actually could. Because you are perfectly qualified to do what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you're doing it for all the right reasons. Mm. And you can't, but you're purely empathetic to the people who you represent.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for saying that. I suppose other solicitors, I would say, are maybe naturalised citizens, whereas I'm a native. I was born in medical negligence, so I kind of, I haven't, whether or not I go on to be a solicitor for the next 50 years, I'll always be, medical negligence will always be in my life in that way. Do you know what I mean? So
When you go to people and they meet you and you introduce yourself and you tell them your story, what's the reaction?
That I get it. They don't have to do a whole lot more explaining after that. They don't have to tell me that it's not about money, that it's to do with getting answers and an explanation as to what's happened, because they come into me and they don't know what's gone wrong. They just know they're worse off, or their child is paralysed and, you know, could have cerebral palsy, and they just want to know what happened because no one's told them yet. And they know when they're talking to me and I'm able to tell them my story that they don't have to explain where they're coming from. I know it. I know exactly where they're coming from.
And you have to be across, and this is your interest in medicine, you have to be across all that, don't you, to argue points in a court of law?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you have to kind of, what is it, keep the heart on fire and the brain on ice. You have to kind of look at it from the, you have to keep a cool head and not let it get to you too much, and you also have to be able to manage their expectations and say, you know, I won't be deciding whether or not there's been negligence here. It's the evidence in the records combined with what an expert in the same field of medicine as the person they're taking a case against says. So there's plenty of conversations where I've had to let people down and say, you have a disability similar to mine, could be worse, but I can't do anything further from you. As a solicitor, I can't do anything more, which obviously isn't nice, and it does hurt me a little bit. It hurts as you get on in the career, you're able to kind of, I suppose, deal with it better, but it doesn't make you...
And you cite your disability in a court of law?
No.
No, I mean, do you say, Your Honour, or whatever?
Oh, well, I suppose it's the barrister that would be doing it.
Yeah, the barrister would be doing it, he'd be arguing the point.
Yeah, yeah.
I watch too many movies.
Yeah, I know, because there's the lawyers in America which kind of confuses matters. Yeah. No, I don't know. I know I've represented families at inquests, which are terrible. I mean, you know, to do with someone having died, and I do like to take the passion from what's happened to me into it. And if a doctor isn't being necessarily upfront about things when I'm asking him questions, that invigorates me, because it's what happened. Mum and Dad were told not only what happened, not what happened, but they weren't told. They were kind of told it was somehow or in some way Mum's fault.
Yeah,
you know,
so. And did the same barrister who worked on your case all of what, 24 years ago?
1996.
Yeah, there you go. Work on Alice Hayes' case.
Yeah, Dr. John O'Mahony. And Dr. John was revered in our family, and I knew his name before. I think his name was up there beside David Beckham and all the other idols growing up. You as well, Ray. And it was kind of pinch yourself stuff when I was there settling that case beside John. And his daughter, Dearon, as well, who's a barrister. So was, you know, fast forward and you're kind
and
of...
And he's a doctor of law or...
Medical doctor, but went on to become a barrister, yeah. And,
and would that be
counsel.
Common in
There are a few.
In that field,
there
yeah.
are a few, yeah. I suppose the intersect between medicine and law is very interesting
yes.
anyway, so I suppose some of them probably do want to... Yeah.
And are both your parents still alive?
They are, yeah. Mum had a kidney transplant there 2 years ago.
How is she?
Yeah, grand, yeah, fine. That's the diabetes for you. It's
yes.
just her brother.
And how was she after your birth?
Well, psychologically, I think not great. I mean, she obviously fought for me, and I think she obviously had to kind of be her best for me and for Stefan as well. But I suppose it's something I don't think she probably wants to talk to me too much about, because I can imagine it would bring up, you know, feelings that she's done such a great job of kind of managing between counselling and with.
And she went on to have another child, younger sibling.
Yeah, Annika, yeah. And would you believe shoulder dystocia happened in there as well, but they were watching her like a hawk. And it was in Holles Street. She moved up to Dublin for 3 months beforehand because she obviously lost all faith in Galway. Annika, the shoulder got caught the same way, but she was 8 pounds, I think, so they had no real trouble getting her out. It's testament to her strength that she went on and had another baby.
And apart from your arm, you're...
I'm okay, I suppose, yeah. I'm not as brain damaged as I thought I'd be anyway. Yeah, no, I'm grand. It is the arm. It's where it's the only disability that I have. It's the only paralysis that I have. But, I mean, my... concern now would be as I get older, obviously, arthritis. What happens if another limb goes? What happens if I get arthritis in my, you know, because I can't use crutches. I'd have to use an electric wheelchair, really, is the only.
Right.
And I have had to adapt my car and that kind of thing. I have had to take a few steps to make things a bit easier.
And you don't get a grant for your car?
No.
A disability grant? No.
No. It has to be your lower limb, either a lower limb, both lower limbs, or both upper limbs. One upper limb. One arm isn't...
Doesn't qualify.
No, which I find hard to believe, but
you
I've been around
to have
houses.
Your car adapted?
I have, yeah, at a cost of more than the car. Yeah, the adaption cost 3 and the car cost 2.5. So, and if that's specific to that car, so if I get a new car, it's off again to get adapted at probably at a similar price. So
that doesn't make sense to me.
I know. Me neither.
The whole dating thing worked out.
Oh yeah,
Becky.
Becky, exactly. Yeah, and we have a baby boy, Irla, which you can imagine. I was a nervous passenger, but I tried my best not to be a diva when we went in. We paid for an obstetrician privately, ironically, with money from my settlement.
Right.
That the consultant was lovely. He was very, you know, attentive, and he understood where I was coming from. And that we have Irla to thank, we have him to thank for Irla. And I suppose I do appreciate.
So you were there at the birth?
I was, yeah. That was difficult. I had a very much a why me moment at one stage. I saw everything they were doing.
Why did it happen to you?
Yeah, because I could see everything they were doing for Irla and for Becky, and I was delighted. And I mean, I never walk around with a t-shirt normally, because the arm, I would be kind of self aware. But I was marching up and down the labour ward with my arm out and my t-shirt, making sure that if they saw it, they might remember it or they might think about it. It's stupid, like, but
no.
In my mind, it was for their betterment. But anyway, I remember the pushing and the delivery. It was a beautiful moment, but it was weird. It was tinged with a bit of regret that it didn't happen for me that way.
So it's still obviously with you every day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how do you cope with that? Have you been to counselling, for example?
Do you know, I should have gone to counselling after we had Irla, because it caught me by surprise how I was still... Because between talking with the charity at like family days about living, growing up with Irla's palsy and doing this job, I thought it was all resolved. It probably not. I probably should go to counselling, because there is some There is still, obviously still some kind of like that regret or anger there. But I don't know, my job, I enjoy my job so much as well that it kind of, that's a coping mechanism, I suppose, in one way.
Yeah, and you're channeling.
Yeah, positively.
Very positively. And you lectured for the first time on tort law.
Yeah, when? I did. Just last, oh God, Wednesday. Last right. Wednesday, yeah. So I shared my story with the tort law class, and I'd like to think that that might cause some people to take an interest in.
Where does the word tort come from?
Oh, you know, no idea. God, don't ask me that. Right. I haven't a clue. Yeah, I haven't a clue. Right. Yeah, no, it's... It's the area obviously a law that I was most kind of interested in. Yeah. But and the class were lovely as well. So it was kind of pinch yourself stuff to go back, especially at the age of 30. I thought maybe 45 or 50, I'd be going back sharing some nuggets of information. But that was again.
Yeah, that's nice. Now Johan, listen to Johan. His humanity has me in tears. Thanks, says George. And question for Johan: was his mother injured as a result? We've established that. And he has worn the moccasins. This man has ability in spades to represent for people with disabilities and issues. Super, and with empathy too.
Thank you very much.
There you go.
Dear listeners.
Well, listen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben, for having me.
Yeah, no, and it's been a real pleasure. And thanks. I'm sure we'll hear a lot more of you. Johan Verbruggen. It's not a name you forget in a hurry. Thanks, Johan. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
There you go. Tort is from French and it means wrong. So somebody has been wronged. I think that's tort law. Johan Verbruggen, very impressive young man. Now, as you know by now, a case of the coronavirus has been confirmed in the east of Ireland. In fact, we know it's in Dublin. The patient is a male student. He's been treated in a Dublin hospital after returning from northern Italy. His secondary school in Dublin has begun a 2-week shutdown as a precaution against the spread of COVID-19, the coronavirus. And the HSE said that contact tracing has commenced. So to find out more about contact tracing, we have Dr. Breda Smith, Director of Public Health with the HSE West. Good afternoon, Breda. Thanks so much for taking time out, because I know you're a very busy woman.
You're very welcome, Ray. Thank you.
So describe to me the process of contact tracing.
So contact tracing is the identification and follow-up of people who may have come in contact with an infected person. So this is a mechanism that we carry out regularly in public health, and we apply it to investigations, say, following a case of meningitis or a case of measles, or sometimes in outbreak situations in creches of VTEC E. coli. So it's something we're very familiar with in public health practice and investigations of infectious diseases. What happens in a situation with contact tracing is that an interview is carried out with the actual case. And through discussions with the case, an overview of the social network of that case is identified. And through that social network, potential close contacts are then identified through their movements. Then these close contacts are then interviewed to assess, carry out a risk assessment, really, and the level of contacts that these people would have had with the case. A close contact is defined as a person who had greater than 15 minutes face-to-face contact in less than 2 metres. So if there are guidelines in relation to how you risk assess people, there are other situations, as you know, for risk assessment and for those contacts who have shared a closed space with a confirmed case for longer than 2 hours, risk assessments are undertaken and taking into consideration other situations like the size of a room, the ventilation of the room, the distance from the case. Okay. So, and this may include an office or a school setting.
So close contact, definitely members of the family.
Yes, household contacts are considered close contacts.
Right. Okay, we're talking about a school here. So other members of the class, close contact or not close contact?
So as I say, we follow strict criteria or clear guidelines in relation to how we define close contacts. So if they fulfill the risk assessment in relation to a close space and for the duration of time that they would have contact with the case, that's how we carry out a risk assessment in these situations.
Okay. And then when you find people who have been in close contact with a person who has been diagnosed with coronavirus, what happens then?
So what happens next then is that each individual is given very clear guidelines in relation to what they should do. So in the situation of COVID-19, the first thing that close contacts should do is that they would be asked to limit their movements and interactions with others as far as is practical. And this means that they should avoid attendance at any social gatherings, crowded closed settings, healthcare facilities, childcare facilities or school settings during the period of active monitoring. So they will be actively followed up for 14 days after the exposure to the case. They will be asked about their risk and the symptoms of, and advised about the symptoms of COVID-19. They will be reminded about adhering to adequate respiratory etiquette and hand hygiene practice. Mm-hmm. And contact will be made with them daily over the 14-day period. Also, they are advised if they do actually become unwell with any of the symptoms which they're advised about, which are fever, cough or shortness of breath, that they should immediately telephone their local public health department.
It's sort of like investigating a crime, isn't it, really? How many people would work on contact tracing within the HSE?
Well, it actually takes up quite a bit of our time in departments of public health, and it's probably time that people don't see because we're not actively treating cases, because we're trying to prevent cases. So this is what public health doctors do all the time, but it is very resource intensive, and it can be, particularly in situations like this. However, it's something we do all the time in relation to TB cases, lots of different quite complex situations where there has to be a lot of risk assessment carried out.
And people will be reassured to hear that it's something that you do on a regular basis.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And is there a point then where you stop doing it, where the number of cases exceeds, 1,000 or something like that?
Well, we adhere to the international guidelines. So we follow best practice. And there are situations that we do it all the time. So, so for example, in cases like meningitis, we would always carry out contact tracing, similarly with measles, similarly with TB cases. So we adhere to the international guidelines as to when we should carry it out and when we should not.
But this is a new virus. So who lays down the guidelines? Because there's no precedent.
The guidelines are being developed by the World Health Organization and the European Centre for Disease, Communicable Disease, and we are being informed by the evidence that they are giving to us in relation to the guidelines. We are currently still in the containment phase, and during this phase, our task is to interrupt the transmission of this virus. So we have to take every step possible to interrupt transmission. This includes primary and secondary prevention. One of the most important messages we could get across are our primary prevention messages, and that is with regard to hand hygiene and respiratory etiquette. So it is really important, and I can't reinforce it enough, that all members of the public practice very strict hand hygiene practices, that we wash our hands thoroughly for 20 seconds and use hand sanitizer if we have access to it. Also, if we have any sort of respiratory symptoms, we should practice very good respiratory etiquette. If we're using tissues, to bin them straight away and to wash our hands and to sneeze into our sleeves if necessary.
All good advice, yeah.
Yes, and then contact tracing is a secondary prevention tool whereby we try to once again stop the interrupt the chain of transmission.
Yeah, so it's containment. And what happens, I suppose that's my question, what happens after containment?
So the next phase in epidemics is mitigation. And but we are not at that stage yet. And mitigation generally comes when you have widespread community transmission. We are very much still in the containment phase in Ireland. We have one case in all of our country. So we really have to adhere strictly to our containment guidelines at the moment.
Okay.
Until such time as that changed.
As I say, you're obviously very busy, so thank you so much for taking our call. Dr. Breda Smith, thank you. Director of Public Health with HSE West.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
And I wonder how that poor teenager who's at the centre of all this feels. He's in isolation, but he's not been isolated from the news. So our thoughts are with you. not a good claim to fame, really, is it, that you're the first person in Ireland to have the coronavirus? No wrongdoing on his part whatsoever, just unfortunate and unlucky. Now, on the driving test, because it starts tonight, the test on RTE television, and we're going to be talking to Dennis after 4 o'clock. He features in the programme. Paul is benign, says, my wife and I passed our driving test on the same day in 1974 with the same tester. My wife did her test first and passed, and I went next to be tested and did not know how she got on. When I'd finished, my tester said, I've just passed your wife, so I better pass you or there'll be rows in your home for the rest of your life. That's a great story. And this one, listening to you from Long Island, New York, which tests one's driving skills, let me tell you, New York drivers, oh my God. Anyway, my driving test story, it was 2003 and there was a backlog and the date for my test was the day before I was leaving for a year to Australia. I decided it was all meant to be and a good sign. I'd be known as quite the emotional creature, so preparing to say goodbye to my parents for at least a year mightn't have helped the nerves. Soldiered on, was taking the test and all I could think of was saying goodbye the next day. I recall the instructor slightly jerking forward at the end of a downhill and couldn't understand why the test had ended before being asked to parallel park or three-point turn. On parking, I looked at the instructor in hope. He said, you have failed. Do you know why? I said, no. I had sailed straight through a stop sign at the bottom of a aforementioned hill, but for the grace of God, I got to Oz in one piece. Took me till 2007 to get the nerves up again to retest and passed. That's Siobhan Meehan-Smith. Congratulations, Siobhan Meehan-Smith. And the best present I ever got was on my 18th birthday when my father bought me a driving licence. I'm 77 years old next week and I've never done a driving test. In my youth, there were no driving tests and you just bought one over the counter in the County Council Motor Tax Office. I always feel that I probably would not pass a test now if I was obliged to take one. But this doesn't stop me from criticising other drivers. That's Paddy Smith. Good on you, Paddy. Just on bacon, you can put pumpkin seeds or sunflower seeds instead of nuts in the bread. All right, I might try that. And Mary in Cork says, forget all the rubbing in of the butter. I add 2 ounces or whatever of a good oil, olive or rapeseed, and mix it with the milk. Always works. But as bread making is a science, it all depends on the milk and bread soda amalgamating. Enjoy. It's good for you. Mary in Cork. And I've just put my brown bread in the oven and instead of butter I just add 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil. We think it tastes even better than using butter. Happy bacon, says Aidan in Wexford. And on the film movie Parasite, brilliant film, part comedy, social commentary, drama, crime and horror movie. Sure, where would you get it? Yeah, there's all of that. It's all of that, Sal. It's value for money. There's so much in it. Parasite, highly recommend it from here. Now, the first time Dennis Murray did his driving test was back in 1974, correct, Dennis?
About that, yes.
Which you failed.
I failed it then, yeah. I did it down in Portlaoise, so of course I was living in Dublin for a long time. So I didn't really know Portlaoise.
That's right.
It was a bit stupid actually at the time, per se. Yeah. That's what I did.
So 45 years later, Dennis has done it again. And this time it's been filmed for the test, which airs this evening at 7:30 on RTE1. So you've been sort of on the road for 45 years.
I've been on and off over the years. Like I started driving about 14, 15, well, 15, I suppose, my dad would help me, you know. But I came to Dublin then, got a job in the course, I wanted my first car. So I did lessons then in Churchtown at the time. So over the years then, I had 2 cars stolen on me. So then I sort of got a bit disheartened and I'd buy a car again and then start all over again. But the test, the driving test never really appealed to me, you know, it just didn't.
Why not?
I just thought it was only a piece of paper, like, and sure, you know, I can drive. I don't need a piece of paper to tell me that. You know, I was a bit of a rebel, I suppose.
Yeah, so. And what about then back in the, was it the 70s or the 80s, when if you had 2 provisional licences, you could get a full licence?
Well, I still never bothered. I just kept renewing the licence all along over the years.
Right.
And as I said, there was breaks then when I wasn't driving. So you just went, got your provisional again and started off again. Okay. So it was like.
So why did you decide to get involved in the program?
My 2 daughters, Louise and Sarah, over the years were sort of saying, "Daddy, would you ever do your test?" And of course, the more they asked, I wasn't really listening at the time. I sort of, no, it's okay, I don't need it. So then with the new regulations brought in, Shane Ross brought him in, I think it was 2019, he brought some new laws in so the car would be seized. And I sort of had thoughts, right, so if I'm stopped by the guards on the M50, myself and my wife are standing there with no car.
So that'll be the third car gone.
I thought that'd be the third car gone. So I thought I can't cope with this. So then I went and I booked my lessons. And
At 64?
I suppose in a way I was forced into it. But yeah. I was happy. I sort of had my mind made up. There's a time for everything, I think, anyway, in this world. So,
And why did you agree to do the TV programme? Because as if the whole thing wasn't nerve-wracking enough doing your test after all these years, then to have the cameras there as well.
I started doing the lessons and then my Brian Hughes, who was my instructor, he said, Dennis, we've been asked to go on television to do a... I actually didn't realise I was going to be filming the test now at the time. So I said no. I said, you must be crazy, like. So then I said, right, I'll do it. You know, we do it for the crack. And yeah, Brian said, come on, we do it for the crack, show and see what happens. And then Dara and Ruth and them said, look, don't worry about it because no matter what happens, we'll cut out any of the bad parts.
Okay.
So if you have a row, don't all know about it, you know. So we had some fun.
I know you had some fun.
Oh, right? We had a fair, yeah. Brian was...
I've been instructors, right? I've had to sign a contract to say, yeah. I can't divulge whether you pass or not.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Can I ask you, do we see you featured in two tests tonight or one test? Or
I think it's just the one.
Just the one?
No, I'm not. I actually don't know because all this, I was on my phone last night and on Facebook and all of a sudden I saw this Dennis Murray and I thought, what the hell is that? So since last night, and then I got a call from yourselves today from Dara phoned me at lunchtime.
You've gone viral, Dennis.
I'm just absolutely, all over the place, but passing the test, it has been one of the greatest.
He's giving it away there. He said it. I didn't ask him the question. He said it. There you go. I was doing my best.
But I had to go back the second time.
Yeah. But you passed and we can divulge now. Dennis passed this test. Yay! After 45 years.
After 45 years. Yeah, two
And what did it mean to you?
It meant an awful lot because I was going out and with the new regulations, I was a bit nervous. And even though I was stopped in checkpoints and the guard, I think he looked at me and thought, well, that guy's not up to too much anyway, you know. So go ahead, you know. And thanks, guard. Thank you very much. And just kept going. But it has been just, I got so emotional when I was handed the thing, you passed. I just, I never thought it would mean so much to me. I really didn't. It was just incredible. And the peace of mind I have, like, just going out, you know.
And you're sort of, Jessica can't drive anymore, your wife.
Well, Gemma, no.
Gemma, sorry.
Gemma. She could never drive because of she's epilepsy. And so she depends on me to bring her everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Because she can't. And even with buses, she's not really well enough to travel in them all the time, you know. Yeah. She's quite independent, but... if she has a seizure, you know, then we have to go to hospitals, hospital appointments in Beaumont or Vincent. So it's all, you know.
So all of that was sort of playing on the back of
your mind.
It was
because I would be going to Beaumont and I'd be a bit anxious and then to Vincent's. And then if anything happened anyway, it was pure stupid, you know. But it was really growing up in the old days when you know, there was a terrible thing, it'll be fine, it'll be okay, you know. And... sort of growing up in that way that you don't and then this country has changed so much and all for the better actually, you know. And I have to thank Shane Ross for it because only for him I'd probably never.
Well, he needs a bit of love at the moment.
He does.
So because of his regulations, forced you into taking your test.
It made me think
which
I got eventually, And
did you vote for him? Is he in your constituency? No, you're
no, he's not my constituency, so I can't reveal that. I like him as a journalist. He's a good man as a journalist. Yeah, I like Shane.
That's a nice way of putting it. Okay.
Yeah.
So tonight it's on at 7:30 on RTE1. You will see Dennis and others as they prepare for their driving test. Some pass, some fail. Mm. We can divulge today, although contractually it wasn't allowed, that Dennis passed. Yay!
Thanks.
Well done,
thanks,
Dennis Murray. Well done.
Thanks,
good stuff. Congratulations.
Thanks a million.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Conor Pope joins us in studio. In contact Conor for any of your consumer issues on pricewatch@rte.ie. I'll have to get, there's something wrong with these headphones. I'm getting sort of phasing and all sorts of things. But anyway, I'll
that's just age, right?
No, it's not. I was thinking that maybe the brain has gone a bit wonky, but I think it's the headphones. Anyway, Conor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, right?
What's your driving test story?
Do you know what? I didn't learn to drive until I was in my 40s. And I failed my driving test twice in the same 48-hour period. And I doubt there's anybody else in the country who can lay claim to having done that.
I have a story here. It's similar,
okay,
but not the same. My mother-in-law started to drive late in life,
yeah,
like you. After failing the driving test several times, she applied to repeat it in Naas as well as in Dublin.
Yeah.
The two tests coincidentally were on the same day.
Oh, no way.
Dublin in the morning and Naas in the afternoon. She failed in Dublin and arrived in Naas to find the same examiner who had failed her that morning. Needless to say, her journey to Naas was a waste of time because he failed her again.
So not only did she, yeah, so she actually trumps my story, but
did she?
But, yeah, because, but you see what happened is my dad was always on me to learn to drive. He said it's an important life skill. You're an adult now. You have to learn to drive. He paid for driving lessons for me all the way through. And I went on my first driving lesson when I was in my early 20s and I just hated it. I had this guy shouting at me and I was like, ah, Lord, I don't need that. And then I lived in urban settings. So I lived close to city centres until I was in my, in my 40s. Yeah. And then I figured, okay, I have to learn how to drive. I booked my two tests. One was in Galway and one was in Dublin because people told me that if you booked, there was a time when there was lots of waiting lists. So if you book two, you'll have time to fail one and then practice and you'll have time to pass the second time. So I went to Galway first, borrowed my sister-in-law's car. It was the most atrocious driving test. It was just mortifying. Like I had no idea how to drive. I was absolutely useless. And we got out of the car and we're walking to the test station and the guy says, you haven't been driving very long, have you? And that was my clue that I hadn't passed the test. So I failed that test. And then the very next day, I had to go to Dublin, did the test again, and I was equally atrocious. And so I failed that test. And then I kept doing it. And I'd love
how many, to be, many did you do?
Oh, I'd say I did about six in total.
Did you?
Yeah. It just wasn't my thing. And my wife will even tell you, she doesn't think I'm a great driver now either, because, I have other skills in life, Like I can drive and I can, I have a full license and I can get from A to B, but yeah, it's never been something that I enjoyed.
Right.
And I know, because it's funny enough, my brother, by contrast, like he, at 18 years old, he passed his test first time out and was whizzing around the place from 18 on. It was just never my thing.
Think about the future where you have self-drive cars.
Well, that's what I was kind of holding out for, to be honest. But, we were promised jetpacks in the 70s. They never materialised. And now we're promised self-driving cars. So we'll wait and see what happens.
You were writing about the coronavirus over the weekend. Are you an expert on it now?
Well, like a lot of journalists, one of the things that we don't tell people is we can kind of pretend to be experts on certain things and then something else comes along and you can pretend to be an expert on that. Yeah. So, we did do a big, extensive piece, a Q&A in the Irish Times.
Very informative.
On Saturday.
Yeah.
And it's myself and Paul Cullen, who's our health editor, did it. And, what you try and do is you try and give people as much information as you possibly can without being alarmist or without speculating on what might happen or what mightn't happen. One of the things that a point we made in that Q&A is that it's a constantly evolving situation. And when I wrote it, there was no cases in Ireland. And then there was a case in Belfast. So we tweaked it on that basis. And then over the weekend, of course, there was a confirmed case in the Republic of Ireland. And who knows where we're going to be in 5 or 6 weeks? Because the interesting thing is that, I've been following it since January, because it's one of these things that's always filled me with dread, these kind of pandemic type viruses or epidemics. And it's weird to think that 6 weeks ago, something that was based in central China, in a city that most of us had never heard of, is now here. And it just shows you the speed at which these
how small the world is
and the speed at which these illnesses spread. And I think the health authorities, they deserve all the credit in the world, because I was listening to the contributor before the news. It's all about containment. It's all about washing your hands. It's all about proper hygiene. And even still, that it'll still spread. It's going to still spread around the world. And it's like, it is scary. It's a scary time for people.
Mm. Paddy Murray has written a piece for the Irish Times. It's online there. People should read it.
Yeah, about living with, like, you know, he's getting frustrated that people are saying, oh, so it's only a mild illness. It's not a mild illness if you've got a pre-existing condition.
Yes.
Or if you're it's in some way immunocompromised. And that's, you know, that's why everything has to be done to try and contain it. And then if containment fails, everything has to be done to try and manage the situation.
Okay, this came into Pricewatch at RTE.ie. Dear Connor, I bought a laptop 14 months ago and spent just over €1,000 on it. All was well until just before Christmas when it started acting up. It would shut down all of a sudden and the battery would go from full to zero in less than an hour. I brought it back to the shop and was told that because it was out of warranty, I would have to spend nearly €500 on repairs. That seems crazy. Surely I should expect such an expensive product to last longer than 14 months.
This is a query, and this is an issue that comes up constantly amongst listeners to this show and readers of the Irish Times. And it's the difference between your rights as a consumer and warranties. Now, a lot of the time, retailers will just blanket refusal to entertain you once a 12-month period has passed, because they'll say, oh, well, you're out of warranty now, so there's nothing we can do for you. I'm sorry. Now, that's not the law. You have rights under consumer law that extend well beyond a 12-month warranty. And it's important that when people go into retailers in situations like this, or when they contact people over the telephone with scenarios like this, they are informed as to the facts, because knowledge is power. And if you know what your rights are, you can argue the toss much more effectively with a retailer who's just going, oh no, that's out of warranty now. Now, the warranty is an extra benefit. To put it in really simplistic terms, it's an extra benefit a manufacturer gives somebody when they buy a product. So they will say, okay, well, if something goes wrong within this set period of time, we'll give you a redress. But it doesn't in any way trump consumer
law. Rights, yeah.
And under consumer law, under the Sale of Goods Act, consumers have the right to seek redress for a faulty item for up to 6 years after they buy the product. Now, that law has limits. So, for instance, if you buy a €10 watch in a shop on Moore Street and it breaks after a year and a half, you're not going to be able to claim anything by way of redress under the Sale of Goods Act, because it's a cheap product and as a result you can't really expect it to last forever. But if you spend €6,000 on a sofa and after 3 or 4 years the sofa just falls apart, well, then you have rights under the law to go to seek redress. And the redress is the same after 8 months into the lifespan of the product, or 5 years into the lifespan of the product. You have the right to repair, refund, or replacement. Now, it's almost like a sliding scale. So the longer you have the product, the less likely you're going to get the full value of the product back.
Yeah.
So if you have a sofa for 5 years, you know, and you paid €5,000 for it, you wouldn't expect to get €5,000 back because you've had 5 years of use of the sofa. To put it really simply. Now, there's another issue here. The manufacturer gives the warranty, but your contract is with the retailer. So a lot of the time retailers, and they will say things like, oh, well, that's out of warranty, so there's nothing we can do. Your contract isn't with the person who supplies the warranty, it's with the retailer. So they can only adhere to consumer law.
So it's interesting, the warranty is a bonus.
It's an extra thing, yes. But it doesn't exclude you from making a claim under existing consumer law. Now, there's certain rules. So, for instance, if a fault appears in some products, like a laptop, if the fault appears in the first 6 months, well, then the burden of it's assumed that the fault was in the product when you bought it.
Yeah.
But if the fault appears after 6 months, well, then the burden of proof switches to the customer, and the customer then has to try and establish that it wasn't them who threw the laptop, say, in the bath, and now the laptop doesn't work, and they're trying to seek redress. And to be entitled to a repair, a replacement, or a refund, the retailer would have to send the product off to be assessed by qualified engineers or computer technicians or whatever it might be. And then they would send a report back and say, OK, well, this is what was wrong with the product. It was either faulty because of the manufacturers, or it was faulty because you threw it in the bath.
Exactly.
And at that point that you can seek redress. But the product has to get sent off first. And it's not good enough that a retailer would look at it and say, ah, no, that's water damage. So the person in this scenario has more rights than they think they have.
Okay. It's only 14 months.
But it's not without its complications.
Right.
And it isn't also, we can't take it as a given that the product is now faulty as a result of the manufacturer. It could be that that person who owned it mistreated it in some way, and that's why it needs to get assessed. So the process is slightly longer than this person might like. But it's very important that when you go into a shop in the scenario like this and they talk about warranties, you refer to the Sale of Goods Act. And under the Sale of Goods Act, you have a 6-year window, which is seek redress. And under European Union consumer law, you have a 2-year window. So no matter which law applies, this person would have a right to seek redress. So, and they have a right to get that laptop assessed and then to see the report, and then they can establish what they do next.
Okay. While we have you and we have a little bit of time before we finish up today, we were talking last week about travel with the coronavirus and what people's rights are. And of course, we're a week on now and things have changed, and we have two cases on the island of Ireland, and people are asking more and more questions about their plans for travel in the future, weeks and months. So what's your advice now?
Well, it hasn't really changed, because we don't know where we're going to be in the summertime. So it could be the case that the virus peaks quickly and is starting to dissipate come June, July. That would be an ideal scenario. It could be the case that it's spread everywhere by June, July, in which case the travel restrictions would make absolutely no sense. I mean, arguably, if let's say, just take worst case scenario, let's say that the virus is everywhere in the European Union by June. Well, then you're as safe in Dublin as you are in Lisbon.
So it's like the flu.
But then you have to make a decision based on, okay, well, I'm going to be travelling. And there are certain things that you can do when you're travelling. I mean, that might be the scenario when people would choose to wear face masks. Certainly hand hygiene would be very important when they're flying. But speaking personally, I have my holidays booked for Portugal. I'm going to Portugal in July. Today I have to pay $1,000 off the cost of that holiday. I'm paying the €1,000 because, you know, I want to go on holidays in July, so I'm going to pay the money. Now, what I would stress to people is your travel insurance policy is extremely important in this case. Mm. Okay. Now,
People can take out travel insurance.
You can
now.
Absolutely.
There's a window between when you take it out and when it becomes active.
Not really. So, like, let's say if I want to take out an annual travel insurance policy, right, with any company, I can take it out now, and it'll cover any reason for cancellation or curtailment. You know, there's certain clauses in it until I go. But the key clause to look out for in a travel insurance policy in an instance like this is you want a policy that covers official state advice not to travel to a particular area, because that will be the only reason a person shouldn't be travelling this summer. So if the government, if the Department of Foreign Affairs issues an advisory saying you cannot travel to Portugal because of risks of the coronavirus, well, then a person with the right travel insurance policy will be able to claim the costs back. Now, the travel insurance industry have issued a very, you know, detailed statement on this. The first instance you would seek the money back from the tour operator that you booked your holiday with. Then you would seek the money back from the airline if you had flights booked. And and the third avenue you go down is you seek to get the money back from your travel insurer. But you have to be covered. Your travel insurance policy has to cover official state advice not to travel to an affected region. So it's very important when people are booking holidays now that their travel insurance policy has that clause in it. Now, there are only a small number of countries where the advisories are in place now. So I think China is one of the countries where, you know, I couldn't book a holiday to China now and then cancel it and claim back on the travel insurance, because the Department of Foreign Affairs warning not to go to China is already there. But the Department of Foreign Affairs hasn't warned people not to travel to Italy. It's warned people against going to 10 affected regions in Italy. The Department of Foreign Affairs hasn't warned people not to go to Spain, to France, to Portugal, wherever. So if those warnings are in place, and it's a big if for those countries, and you have the right travel insurance policy, well, then you're not going to lose out by booking your holidays now. But as I said at the start, it is possible that in 3 months' time, and we've talked about how fast the virus has been spreading, that Wexford will be as safe as Wuhan when it comes to the virus. We just don't know. But I think one of the guiding principles that we should all be living under in a scenario like this, and I said it last week and I'll say it again, is don't panic, don't let hysteria take hold, and just wait and see what happens, because that's the really important thing in the days and weeks ahead.
Well, I suppose the measure of your advice is that you are paying €1,000 of a deposit on a holiday
in July. For Portugal. And fingers crossed that everything is okay. But I mean, it literally, we are at the fingers crossed.
Have you looked into incoming incoming tourists into Ireland?
Well, there has been a, you know, like, the thing is, if we don't know yet what's going to happen in Ireland, because, you know, people need to take a breath and say, okay, one case in the Republic, one case in the North, there may be more. We may be able to stick with the containment phase, as your contributor before the news was saying. We don't know. I mean, the big question mark now hangs over the St. Patrick's Day Festival, which is happening later this week. We don't know. We're going to know this week
what's going to happen there.
But, you know, there is going to be a decline in travel across the world as a result of this. And, you know, I think people are just going to have to work out coping strategies, both businesses and consumers, and how we're going to deal with it, because it's a very, very serious scenario.
Yeah. Okay. Conor, thank you so much for that. Pricewatch@rte.ie if you want Conor's advice on any consumer issues, and he'll get working on that. That's it from us. Philip Outer-Hayes is on the way with Drive Time. We're back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening.